everyone, and welcome to MedEdge. I'm Marcus Grimm. You know, today's medical students have more options than ever. Many are going to stay true to that proven path, building fulfilling careers within healthcare as we know it. We've got a second group. They're becoming healthcare consultants. They work in pharma or in research. There's a third group. We refer to them as the medical technologists, and that would include Santosh Cherian, CEO of Metrix, who's joining us on today's program. And they get into building the software for the next generation of healthcare learners and professionals. Now, today's guest, Dr. Daniel Paul, offers a fourth path, and it's one that's intended to keep physicians closer to their patients while growing their autonomy through direct care. Dr. Paul is the founder and CEO of Easy Orthopedics, which is one of the first direct care orthopedic practices. Located in Colorado Springs, Easy Orthopedics is designed from the ground up so that patients get to spend more valuable time interacting with their physician. Today, we'll be learning the secrets to where Dr. Paul finds that time. Our audience within the UME and GME community should also be aware that Dr. Paul is also the author of So You Got Into Medical School, Now What? A Guide to Preparing for the Next 4 Years, which just sounds like a terrific book. Dr. Paul, welcome to MedEdge.
Hey guys, thanks for having me on.
Now, because our audience is made up of UME and GME faculty and administrators, you have so much that you can share with us today about direct care. We're going to be talking about that, but we always like to hear the origin story. So what can you share with us about your decision to pursue medicine as a career?
So going back, I mean, no one in my family was a doctor at all. I think I'm really the only one now. So my family is filled with engineers, lots of civil engineers, chemical engineers, you know, for generations, really. And that's probably what I would have done had I not had a bad skiing accident when I was 14. And I broke both my legs and my right arm pretty badly. I skied into a tree. And that was like around the time of like Sonny Bono and one of the Kennedys. So it was right on brand, I guess, for the time period. But that took me out pretty good. And after that, I underwent a lot of orthopedic surgeries. And then I kind of got back to it. And I ran track in high school the next year, albeit slowly. At that time. But I said, this is pretty cool. I mean, I went from being really debilitated to, you know, running again, or running for the first time. So I said, this is pretty cool. I think this is what I want to do. I mean, and that's a pretty common story with orthopedics. Maybe not that level of trauma. Most of the time, it's somebody who plays sports, tears their ACL, goes through the rehab protocol like science. So that's pretty common among us. So when I went into medicine, I just wanted to do orthopedics, you know, which you have to hide somewhat when you interview because, you know, you're interviewing with all primary care docs mostly. And so they don't look too kindly on that. That's a different story. But that was kind of my origin story into medicine.
Awesome. So essentially, you knew right from the beginning where you were going to go, like your path. And that's kind of unusual when it comes to some medical students. You know, you kind of get into medical school, then you have these experiences. Was that something that you kind of stuck to throughout your 4 years? This is like your path and that's it.
Yeah, I would say the latter. So, I mean, as far as figuring out what you want to do, that's probably a much healthier way to do it. So you can like actually experience these specialties and find what you like and find a good match quality. But, you know, I'm just so stubborn that I was like, this is it. It was like ortho or bust, which isn't uncommon, you know, with some of these more difficult specialties to get into. You know, you kind of have to be that way. Otherwise, every once in a while, someone comes along who's like just got excellent grades and a really good steps course and can kind of do whatever. But for the most part, you had to plot it out relatively early. I mean, but yeah, I think that probably figuring out what you want to do by experiencing different specialties is probably a better way to go. That's just fortunately or unfortunately, I don't know. That's just not what I did.
I want to ask one more thing, because a lot of times we talk to medical students and one of the things that they're struggling with is, are they going to make the right decision? You know, the fact that you knew right from the beginning that you wanted to go there and that was it. That's like, I often talk to it like, it's like getting married and you kind of knew who you were going to get married to, as opposed to someone else who's like kind of even in their fourth year, there's like, I'm not sure, I'm going to need to try this out. And then whether or not they're going to have a regret later, whether they chose the right specialty, because it's very hard to change that.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to say because, you know, when you make it, you know, because like when people make decisions early, I made a decision at 14. So is my decision at 14 going to be better than a 25-year-old medical student? Like, probably not. You know what I mean? I do think that sampling around is probably a good way to go. I mean, honestly, I mean, I like what I do, but sometimes there's people like me who go all the way through and by the time they finally lift their head up to see their surroundings, they don't like it. And there was never any question. I mean, it makes your medical school path easier in somewhat that you're like, I'm going to just, you know, optimize for this. But yeah, I think if you know, you really, like I said, I made that decision when I was 14. And is that the best decision to make? I mean, for a 14-year-old, maybe. But, you know, how does my 14-year-old self know what my 35-year-old self is going to want? And this is a real question, right? We're coming across a real existential topic here. And like, he wouldn't, right? How could he? So like, ultimately, it's the 35-year-old self. I mean, I'm 38 now, but who's practicing the medicine based on a decision that a 14-year-old made? So again, I mean, I'm lucky. I like what I do. But, you know, there's a lot of existential kind of thought that goes into it. Well, when do you pick it? Why do you pick it? You know, and I think that deciding later on in medical school is really not a bad way to go after you've sampled enough. I mean, that's kind of what the third year is. You're sampling and seeing what you like. And, you know, I had a friend who really was dead set on doing oral maxillofacial type, you know, plastic surgery. And then he did a rotation, like an ENT rotation. He hated it. And he ended up going into peds. So for him, that was a good move, you know.
So you used two words in that last section, which really is a wonderful transition to what we're going to be talking about. The first word that you mentioned was stubborn, because we're going to be talking about your model, which I think you'd certainly agree with is very much on the fringes today. But you also used the word optimize, which I think is super interesting because it seems like the rationale behind what you're doing is all about optimizing both your autonomy as well as your time with patients. Now, direct care is more popular than it was a few years ago, but like I said, we're still kind of operating on the fringes here. So let's sort of set the stage for listeners that may not be aware. So if tomorrow morning I take a fall and it doesn't heal up on its own, how is that patient experience different if I reach out to you than it might be if I reach out to a physician or a practice that may take my health insurance? Just sort of set the stage for us.
Gotcha. So let's say, just for argument's sake, you fell and like your shoulder is hurting you now and it didn't hurt you before, right? So if you were to use your normal health insurance, depending on your health insurance, you may need to see your primary care doc. If they're busy, that could take a while to get in. And then they'll refer you to an ortho doc, which also could take a very long time to get in. And then you go there, you'll probably see the PA or NP, who can be very good, you know, sometimes. It just depends on the experience of the individual. And they'll probably order some imaging for you, might give you a steroid injection, who knows. So that process will take a while. The FaceTime that you're actually going to get with the ortho doc can be zero or minimal, right? Because if they're seeing 40 people a day, you're talking 5 minutes. You've waited for a while. And the cost associated with that depend on your insurance. If you've got really wonderful insurance, you're probably going to be paying a couple copays. But if you don't, and you have a high deductible, or you know, you could be paying on the hook for a lot of money, which you won't know in advance, right? You're not going to really know that until things come out. Even if you have good insurance, if they take you to a procedure room to do the injection, it puts in, there's a lot of funny games they can play, and a lot of practices are optimized that. So that's what your normal practice is. If someone reaches out to me, they call the office. It's two people, me and my wife. We can get them in same day or next day. We'll get any imaging they need. And I meet them. I travel either usually office visit, but sometimes to their house, and they get a full hour with me, which we can talk and figure everything out. And then they know the price they're going to pay up front. So it's a really much more efficient way of doing it for the patient, especially if they have a high deductible or they don't have insurance. It's the most economical option also. So there's a lot of people I see like that. For instance, if you go to the doctor and let's say you hurt your shoulder and your knee and your wrists and everything, nothing broken, let's just say they all hurt, there's no way you're going to get a good visit. In the standard model, they're going to say one problem at a time. But for me, with an hour, I'm very capable of seeing people with multiple problems at once. So I think that's where the model really does good. And it seems inefficient. It seems like, well, you spent an hour with that person. It's like, well, we went over, you know, 6-7 problems. You know, that would take them a lot of visits. So it's actually very efficient in a way for the patient as well. And you can make progress a lot faster. But that's the crux of it. But I don't take any insurances. Direct care practices don't. I can give you a super bill. You can submit it, but essentially you pay me at the end of the visit, cash, credit card, whatever. And that's the end. You're not getting bills or anything like that. And obviously the different stuff you do, there's more nuances to it. But in a nutshell, that's kind of what it is.
Now, one of the things that I noticed, and you have so much great content out on YouTube, but you actually did at least one video where you really talked about some of these inefficiencies that you've taken out of the system. And a lot of them, it seems like, are directly related to the fact that you don't take health insurance. But what can you share with us about some of the inefficiencies that you just found that health insurance introduces into the system that you said, you know what, I don't want to spend my time that way?
Oh, there's so many. I mean, basically what health insurance does is it forces a very high volume practice. Because you need to, if you take health insurance, you know, they control the money going out. So what they try to do is not pay you by making it very difficult to get paid. But, you know, you didn't click the right boxes. You didn't do A, you didn't do B, you didn't do C. So what doctors have done or medical practices have done is they've hired people to make sure all this stuff looks right. So you have your coders, your billers, and then you want to order an MRI. They say, no, we're not, you know how to do A, B, and C. So you have your prior authorization. Now you got all these people and you got to pay them. So that means you got to see a lot of people, but now you need to see a lot of people. You need a bigger office. So all of a sudden, you know, you have an office filled with coders and billers and prior authorizations, and you have multiple exam rooms and maybe you need another doctor, and patients are just streaming in. And the irony is it's not a very stable way to practice, because even though it seems like you are because you're so busy, you can't control your overhead and you also can't control how much you get paid. So a lot of these practices end up going out or having financial difficulties. But yeah, there's so many inefficiencies. Like, let's go with prior authorizations. If I want an MRI, like if you hurt your shoulder and I said, let's get an MRI and your cash pay, $500, I can get you one the same day or the next day. I've had it before where someone's injured their knee. I saw them that morning and I had the MRI report that night, right? I mean, if you don't have that, I mean, the doctor needs to battle with insurance, even make you do 6 weeks of physical therapy. Maybe you don't need to do physical therapy, right? Maybe you do, but maybe you don't. You know, and then even still, they might deny it. So, I mean, there's things like that you can kind of just do the optimal care. I mean, there's constraints with money, of course, with anything, right? You know, like you'll have surgeries that people won't want to do. I mean, so that's a real problem, but that happens. But you remove essentially a third party company who's not interested in helping you get healthcare, who actually is obstructionist most of the time, from your medical care. So in a lot of ways, it's better. I mean, you know, you still have insurance for catastrophic care if you're talking cancer or something like that. I mean, those meds are unaffordable. Not that I do any of that, but, you know, it's not a perfect system. But for most stuff, it works pretty well.
And it's obvious to me, you use the word system there. It's obvious to me you are a systems person. Although I feel like when I say that, I'm being a little bit unfair to you, as that phrase often connotes someone who's adept at building complex systems. But even in your book, so you got into medical school, now what? There's a lot of advice about simplifying your systems and optimizing for time efficiency. And I'm just curious, is that how you've been wired from the get-go, or is that something that you've learned along the way?
I don't know. I mean, I think you're kind of forced to be efficient in med school and in residency if you want to have any time to yourself. So, I mean, I think with that book, it was kind of just an effort to say what I did that I found to be efficient to hopefully save someone time, because there's a lot of things I needed to figure out. Quite a while ago that I wrote that now. But yeah, the systems part, I really like it, because if I think I'm doing something poorly or there's a better way to do it, we can change it immediately. I don't need to talk to the administration. Even if I want to change my consent form or anything like that, I just change it, right? I don't need to go through anybody. You know, as compare that to a hospital, when it can be the dumbest process that you will ever see, that makes no sense to anybody, and it's like decades old, and you make a request like, hey, maybe we shouldn't do it this way, and you get stomped out. I mean, it's not even like, no, this is, you know, first of all, you get, this is the way we've always done it, which for people like me is like the worst thing you can say. And then, you know, there's no changing it. Not even just that you'll have meetings and it's not good. I mean, I'll just give you a simple example from, I said this before, this is from my residency. So I had a pediatric hospital where we did pediatric surgeries. Ortho surgeries. And so when you need to do surgery on a kid, you have to get consent. Like, of course, right? Like, you need to get consent. And if the dad wasn't there, the mom wasn't there, you call them on the phone and there was a checkbox where you can mark phone consent obtained. You'd witness it, whatever. But what they would make you do is hand copy the two consent forms. So one would have one parent, one would have the other parent, even though they could have been combined on one. And so as a third year resident, I was like, well, this is a pretty crazy way of doing it. And it's like, they wrote me up for that, you know? I still did it. It's not like I didn't do it. This has nothing to do with medical care. And it's like, you know, they're very offended that that you're basically like, this is just a ridiculous thing to do. So like, there's so many things like that in medicine.
So obviously you find these, you've seen these things that don't make sense. And I'm curious, direct care, direct pay, that's a relatively dramatic shift in how most physicians practice. What can you share with us about your journey? Did you do it the traditional way and then say, I'm tapping out of this? Or from the jump, if you said, I'm going to do it a different way, what can you share with us about your own journey to do it this way?
Oh, man. So, you know, a lot of things in life are like well thought out and planned, and this is really not one of them. I mean, for better or for worse, right? Like, life is chaotic. Stuff happens. I mean, you're on a very straight linear path in medicine, you know, while you're in training. And then when you're off, it's not like that anymore. You know, everybody thinks they're going to go and get some great job and just work there their whole career and have a picturesque life. And that is the minority of people. I mean, maybe that was true 30, 40 years ago when you could own your own practice, but certainly not true today. So for me personally, going through residency, I never had any inkling. I never heard about it, never thought about it, nothing. So I would take and pass part one of my boards. And then I, you know, which is like a week after residency, which is so unfair. But anyways, different story. And then I start fellowship in hand surgery, right? So I was going to be a hand surgeon. And it's not, you know, not to go into details here, but it's not a positive educational experience, right? I've already finished 4 years of med school, 5 years of residency. This is one optional year. And it's just not a good year. I don't know what to say. So that's going on. I'm like 5 months in. I'm unhappy. It's not good. And I interviewed for a job out in, my wife's from Colorado. I was trying to find a job out in Colorado. I was having a really hard time. I've dragged her all over the country at this point. And like the ones I found are just so bad. I mean, it's like take our entire call for our entire practice all the time, or, you know, here's a 4 month guarantee, you know, standard's 2 years. So for those listening, standard is you get paid for 2 years before you start billing and collecting what you do, because it takes time to build a practice. So 4 months, I've never heard of anything so low. And anyway, so that's going on. So I'm like, I can't find a job. So I interview out in Connecticut at a place, and because I'm from Connecticut. And it's just, I mean, I've said this so many times, it's this old senior partner just bitterly telling me how much money he made in the 90s, how much he made for this, how much he made for that. And it's like just berating the previous hand guy surgeon who left, and just, you know, berating every, you know, just, and this is an interview, and I was with him for a large part of the day. And I'm like, man, you know, like, you know, and then I see a junior attending, which is what I would have been. And I say, well, you know, do you like it here? And he was just like, let me see if I can get this right. He's like, it's getting better. It was like that, the best of my recollection. He is going into the hospital. He's doing his own reductions, which in the world of orthopedics, something you do as a resident, you really shouldn't go into the hospital as an attending to reduce a distal radius. The ER should be able to do that anyways. And he, you know, nobody was giving him cases that he wanted. He was just doing all trauma and picking up what he could. And like, you know, and then the senior attending is like, oh, sports guys, because he's sports medic. And he's like, you could pay those guys whatever you want. There's so many of them. So it's like, great. And that's what he was too. So it's like, you made a lot of money in the early 90s and now you're lowballing people. So I'm like, man, it was like an existential crisis. I'm like, is this what the working world is like? At the same time, I'm unhappy in my fellowship. So it created what I'll say is this negative ball of energy. And it caused me to get derailed, like in a very good way. So I had a friend in medical school, and he had a practice doing like internal medicine in Miami. I went to University of Miami, and like he's doing house calls for cash. And like, man, this guy's happier than anybody I know in medicine. And like he's doing better financially. So it was this existential crisis, unhappiness, negative ball of energy. This idea popped into my head. So I just quit my fellowship, you know, and then give 2 weeks. I just, that was gone. You know, a lot of employee, like if they want employees to give 2 weeks, but employers never do, right? And so, like, well, it's a millennial thing, I guess. And I moved across the country into my in-laws' basement, right? Because like I have no income now. And we wanted to move out to Colorado. And I was like, well, I need to do something. And I knew I couldn't do a standard practice. It just seemed like it was just ripe for failure. I mean, I don't have the overhead to hire all those people and do all that stuff. And I'm like, well, this guy's doing pretty good down in Florida. I'm like, no one's really done this before for orthopedics. I don't know what it looks like, but I'm just going to do it. Really more out of desperation than any sort of like calculated risk taking. And that's where it started. And I mean, it started slow. I didn't know what I was doing. I mean, I think I saw one patient my first month, and I was lucky to get one patient, right? I think the second month it was one patient, and the third month it was one patient, and then it started being more. I mean, it sounds crazy. But you know, I was working from nothing. Nobody had done this. I had to figure out so many things, which is now why I create a course. If someone wants to replicate it, they don't have to go through all that. But that was the process. I mean, obviously now I'm in my own basement. So, I mean, I've, you know, things have worked out. But that was the but I was there for almost 2 years in my in-laws house. That's kind of how it started.
That is such a great story. And I want to pivot here to your YouTube channel. There are so many great videos there. Wonderful content, incredibly educational. But you've already alluded to the fact that your business is a different business. And so seeing all those YouTube videos, it also made me wonder, is that an indication that because when you're a direct care doctor, you're not getting the referral flow that a traditional doctor might. So do you find yourself spending more time devoted to business development and marketing than, I don't know how much Tosh spends marketing his radiology services? I'm going to guess none. And my sense is that doctors within the normal system have very full schedules. So I guess my question is, you're doing these videos. Do you find that marketing and business development is a role that is part of the direct care model?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, if you go to work for a giant hospital system, they're going to load you up. I mean, they're going to take care of that. They have whole marketing arms. You know, they have billboards. They have departments. I mean, you don't have any of that. So who is going to know that you're there? I mean, if you've already been a presence in the community for a while, then maybe, you know, you have word of mouth marketing that previously exists, but I didn't. So yeah, you got to get out and you have to figure out how to tell people about you, what you're doing, where your value points are. I mean, I never pay. I've paid almost nothing. I don't pay for marketing. So for me, it's more networking and word of mouth, which to me is the best, but it's also the slowest. But it's taken time. I mean, I had to meet people in the community, find out who gives me referrals, who doesn't, what type of doc gives me referrals, who doesn't, or am I, what is a good patient for me to see? What's one that I might want to steer away from? Search engine optimization, you know, YouTube videos are part of that. Now they generate a very small amount of revenue. So that's kind of weird, but cool. So yeah, you have to do that. I mean, I guess you can hire someone, but I mean, the best thing in my opinion to do is like just going out and meeting people. And like, look, I did a lot of networking at first that really was not, I mean, I made some good relationships with some good people, but it wasn't necessarily always fruitful. But in the beginning, it just got me out of the house. I mean, I think my first day, I was like, all right, let's figure this. Like, all right, I'm gonna start. And like, Colorado's very it's not like the Northeast where you know people wear suits and everything. But I didn't know that, right? So I'm like wearing a suit around, no tie, thankfully. And I'm like, all right, I'm gonna go to this hotel. It's a fancy hotel in town. I think that they'll be like, this is great. If people get hurt, they can just call me. And like, I went in and they were like, they wanted me just to leave. Like, you know, I was like soliciting. They're like, just get the hell out of here, you know. So I was like, okay, scratch that one off. And then it's like, all right, maybe CrossFit gyms, right? Because like people are always getting hurt. And like I go and they were nice. They'd let me in. They'd show me the facilities. They were cool. Again, I'm giving them too many business cards, which is something you learn later on when someone gives you too many business cards. But like they never referred anything like ever to this day. And it's like, well, I realized like, oh, CrossFit, like all I'm going to do is tell them they can't do CrossFit. That's what they think at least. And like, that's bad. So no referrals from there. You know, they'll see a physical therapist before they'll see me. And sometimes they won't even do that. So it was a lot of that, you know, and just meeting people and finding out like who actually values like what I do. So it took a minute. I mean, it's not an easy process.
One of the things that I love about your work is you seem to be one of those people that once you overcome some significant challenges, you like to share that knowledge with others. You got through medical school and then you wrote a book about how to get through medical school. You figured out direct care and now you have a course on direct care. And I'm curious, when you talk about that course, what are some of the biggest misconceptions or misunderstandings about your model that other physicians can resolve through your course?
So I think that there's a misconception with direct care in general, also with my model, that I'm just treating healthy and wealthy people. And that is just not true. I mean, you do get some people like that every once in a while, like you would in any practice, but majority of the time, you know, you're dealing with people who don't have insurance or who have high deductibles. So I'm the most economical option for them. These are small business owners. These aren't people with like, you know, who are just like living the high life. So there's this thought that like, it's just concierge and you're just only seeing wealthy people. And that's just not the case. Another misconception is that, you know, I call it a cash-based practice, which is what it is. Like I'm opted out of Medicare. I don't contract with any insurance companies. But how I define it more is cash just means not taking insurance. So you can do anything you want as long as you don't have to interact with those insurance-based systems because you don't have the resources for it. So, you know, to be open to that's good. Like if the Department of Defense, I'll do like some small contracting work for them. Personal injury means I need to interact with lawyers, but I don't have to interact with an insurance company. To me, that's functional. Medical legal work, consulting. I mean, the idea is you kind of smoosh these all together. So I think when people think direct care, you know, it's also finding your value proposition, right? So a direct primary care doctor is different than a family medicine doctor in the system. They've figured that out, what that looks like. I'm still pioneering and figuring that out for orthopedics. Like, where does my value proposition like really lie? So the course just kind of takes you through all that and like how to do from building websites to making, you know, meeting people in the community, avoiding traps. Basically, it's how to replicate what I did of everything that I know. You know, because I get inquiries about people that want to know. So it's nice to have something I can point them to. You know, people are sort of reluctant to pull the trigger because they're in their job right now and that's their lifestyle. So it's a big switch. But I think as time goes on and the system of practice gets more and more painful, which it will, you'll find more people kind of switching.
Daniel, one of the things that I picked up on earlier is your age. You said you're 38. I'm 38 too. My path to entrepreneurship is along the same timeline, but I went the tech route. So the tech entrepreneur world is kind of well established and you raise money and you build a product and you get clients and you grow and you continue growing that way. What I'm learning in the last couple of months working with my wife is that I don't know anything about this healthcare entrepreneurship model of being able to establish a practice and grow that, because it's not the same as like growing a tech business, nothing at all. So you have any practical tips? So let's say someone is in a senior residency, like taking the first steps into the logistics of starting something, for example, like are you structured as an LLC or S-Corp? Anything that's practical? What are some of the things that they should think about as the first steps? I know there's a lot of things that you have to figure out, but if someone is in their late training or thinking about it, what would be the first thing that you tell them to do?
Yeah. I mean, what you're talking about before is the difference between like small business and big business. You know, one's not necessarily worse or better than the other, but they're very different ways of approaching the world and things. So I very much have experience in small business and really don't have experience in big business. But yeah, if you want to start, you know, all that like finding medical supplies, LLC and stuff, that's all pretty easy to figure out. Your best bet is to find someone in your community or state who's doing that and just see what they do and talk to them. If you have to pay them, please. They're giving you a lot of knowledge for your time. It'll be worth your money. Most people won't charge you. Sometimes they do. That'll be the best place because that'll give you a wealth of information about what to do in the beginning because they've already done it. You know, don't talk to the people in your practice. Don't talk to administrators who have not done it. They don't know. They'll tell you it won't work because they have no freaking idea. It does work. It does work if you do it right. But, you know, and that's what's happening with some medical students. They say, well, you can't do that. That'll never work. And it's like coming from an academic doctor. Like it means almost nothing. You know, they are a doctor and they're very smart. And I'm sure they're a very good doctor, but they don't know what they're talking about, to be honest. So finding those first steps. But yeah, I mean, the easiest stuff is like you can create a business name. You search online to make sure it's not there in your specific state. You can get an LLC same day. You get the business bank account with articles of organization. And then you get some malpractice and then you have the bare, and then you can actually start seeing people, you know, then you want to get website and up and running, do some search engine optimization. Business cards aren't bad. I mean, it sounds daunting, but all that stuff is real. And, you know, ordering medical supplies and equipment, refurbished equipment, in my opinion, you'll save you a lot of money if you, depending on what you need. But that stuff seems daunting, but it's actually not too bad to create a list and check it off. The hard part is getting patients. You can have the perfectly designed practice, no patients, you don't have a practice. Or you could have a really crappy design practice, but you have patients, you have a practice. So that's where the real crux is. The reason why I like this model, I'm also mobile too, you got to imagine. So my overhead's really low, is that it's extremely durable. You know, I create, my overhead's low. I control how much I bill or how much I make. And, you know, I'm not, you know, I can exist for a while without a lot. Meanwhile, these other models, I mean, you could be a cardiologist running a busy cardiology practice, revenues, you know, $2 million a year and overheads $1.9 million a year. I mean, you know, at the end of the day, you know, you it's not so great.
I want to emphasize what you said there about asking advice. And this is something that I've learned the hard way after running my business for 10 years is getting advice from people that have done it.
Oh, yeah.
Because everybody always has advice in the beginning. But unless you have actually taken the risk of starting a business or growing something and gone through that process, the advice that you're getting may not be helpful. So if you've taken that risk, then you kind of know what the practical steps are.
Yeah, and it can be worse than not helpful. It can be unhelpful. I mean, I'll give you an example with myself. So I've started this practice. I'm like, I'm already, you know, I'm rolling all the dice here, right? And I go to something called SCORE, which I don't know if you know. It used to be called Senior Corps of Retired Executives. It's people that sort of help you, you know, business-wise. So I have a whole business plan, you know, whatever I created. And I meet with this guy and he's really nice and we talk about it. And he used to work HR at like a Fortune 50 company, right? So, I mean, now knowing what I know, I'm like, it's not worth, you know, he's not going to be able to help me. And then I tell him what I'm doing and he's like, I could get this email later. He's like, well, I talked to a friend and I don't think your business is going to work at all. I was like, you know, and it really made me mad, right? I'm like, you know, it really bothered me at the time because I'm like, I think it will work. Like, I have to believe that I'm going for it. And it pissed me off, you know? And then in retrospect, it's like, well, the guy didn't really know anything what he was talking about. And people mean well, but they'll tell you terrible things. I mean, you know, it works like this. In the beginning, they'll tell you it's not going to work, right? They'll always say that. And then once you get it working, they'll be like, well, it's working, but you could really do better if you did something else. And, you know, so I've had that too from other orthopedic surgeons, which is why I don't like talking to them, generally speaking, unless they pay me. And then third is when you get to when you end up being more successful than anyone, they're like, well, you're doing a disservice to society or humanity or whatever, because they don't really understand what you're doing. So those are the stages of the naysayers. You just have to be careful. I mean, talk to someone who's done it. Talk to someone who's successful. By and large, they're going to be very supportive. Like, I talked to my friend who created that practice and he gave me some excellent advice and he was supportive. He says right off the bat, you know, I think you can be successful. You know, you got to do A, B, and C. And I was like, okay. That's useful, not some, you know, retired older gentleman from who never had experience running a small business, let alone a direct care medical practice.
My follow-up question to you is, so when you're doing the direct care, what you're doing is a little bit more complex than someone like, for example, if you're doing primary care where you may not need as much equipment in an OR suite. How did you tackle that?
So ideally, yeah, that could be a problem with OR stuff. You know, obviously my practice is a lot less OR heavy than what it normally would be. So yeah, you have to find surgery centers and sometimes people who have that equipment that you can leverage and pay them rather than buying it all yourself. You know, it's not like I need to create my own surgery center. But that being said, there's also difficulties on that side because until recently, a lot of these surgery centers want you to be part of a hospital system just to work there. So there's certainly problems I've had to navigate. It's not, you know, it's been good, successful, but yeah, I mean, especially on the surgical side, there's certainly difficulties there. But, you know, you'd be surprised what you can do with little. But like, let's say you need a big x-ray machine, you don't have one, find somebody else who does and pay them for the time. Or you might not even have to pay them for the time if you're adding value, you know, or like, I'll just give you an example. I mean, I use a lot of other people's offices because I'm a value add when I'm there. So they don't charge me to use it. But like I casted a 5-year-old girl yesterday and I needed x-rays, right? So I know a chiropractor in town, took x-rays on his machine and they paid him $50. And then I cast her and then they paid me. So, I mean, there's ways around it if you're creative enough and you can make enough connections. You know, people, if they like you, they're usually willing to help you.
So, Daniel, you've been doing a wonderful job of entertaining both our practical questions as well as our existential questions yeah. today. And so for one of my last questions for you, I do want to ask you big picture, you know, do you see yourself as part of an emerging trend? 10 years from now, are direct care physicians going to be still this small sliver? Do you expect it's going to be more commonplace? What do you see happening with this model over the next decade or so?
So yeah, I do think it will grow. I mean, you have to contrast the speed of tech versus the speed of everything else. So the speed of tech moves so fast. I mean, you can have an app that's like going crazy and then 2 years later, it's covered in dust. And medicine is the opposite. It moves very, very, very slow, right? Like still uses the fax machine and a bunch of other archaic things, which don't get me started on the fax machine. I don't have a fax number and I refuse to get one. But
I've seen your video and I'm definitely going to encourage the audience. We're going to put in the show notes Daniel's video about his fax.
Yeah, it was a YouTube video about me hating the fax. I still do. Nothing's changed. But I think it'll continue to grow because practicing medicine is pretty painful for physicians. They're very unhappy and not because they dislike medicine. It's because of the way that they're forced to practice it in these small time blocks with no autonomy, full responsibility, no autonomy. It's not very fun. So I think as more physicians hit this desperation point, you'll see more people defecting into the direct care world direct primary care is pretty well established. I think that'll continue to grow a lot. Direct specialty care, we're just figuring out. So what I'm going to guess is in 10 years, there'll be more people doing direct care. It'll still be very small, but it, you might have more tried and true business models in the different specialties. But it'll certainly be there. I mean, and I think practicing in the system will be, you know, measurably worse as more conglomerations, you know, more hospital systems, more private equity gets involved, you know, just trying to wring the profit out of everything. So I think practicing medicine in the system might hit a tipping point where it gets just, nobody wants to do it. And you'll find everybody, most people going into direct care. And we're not quite there yet.
What's the role, if any, that the UME and GME population plays in facilitating this? You shared with us that you certainly learned about orthopedics in med school, but the business of medicine was something that you were not quite as up to speed on how that would evolve. Is there a role for UME and GME to help facilitate this conversion?
I mean, it's not like you want to enroll medical students in business classes. I mean, they're so busy. It's not going to, you know, like it's not going to jive. You're just going to end up getting an MBA-esque, you know, class about numbers and spreadsheets. They're going to be very bitter about it. I mean, I don't think that's super useful. You know, you're talking not big business, you're talking small business for the most part, which is a different animal. I mean, I think at the very least they could introduce medical students to direct care providers and practitioners in their area so they can at least know that it exists and keep it in the back of their mind. You know, also cautionary tales would be good. About, like, let's say, you know, a doctor who gets out and buys a really nice house and all the cars and works too much and gets divorced and then has nothing or half of, you know, whatever he had. So, you know, I think that stuff, they don't tell you anything about like personal finances and spending. I mean, these are all things that, you know, a lot of docs figure out the hard way. So I think that putting whole courses together might be a lot, but, you know, some exposure and cautionary tales, I think, would leave some lasting impressions, you know, on stuff that's not tested.
And obviously, your website would be a place to start. Dr. Paul, thank you so much for joining us today. This has been fascinating, as I expected. It's a terrific YouTube channel.
Well, thanks, Marcus. Thanks for having me on. You know, if anybody wants to find out more, my YouTube channel is youtube.com/@orthopedics. I got that early, and I'm proud of that. So that's how you can find it. I'm on LinkedIn, Daniel Paul, MD. And my course is, if you go to insurancefreemedicalpractice.com, you'll find the course there, which basically shows you how to replicate my practice and gives you some, I think, like over 30 CME credits. So worth checking out.
Outstanding. Well, change, to be clear, is very, very messy work. Whether you're seeking to optimize healthcare from the inside, as many of our listeners are, or on the outside, as direct care practices like Easy Orthopedics are, either way, tomorrow's healthcare offers up more opportunities for time to be spent performing care and hopefully a lot less time in the business of getting paid for care. We've been speaking today with Dr. Daniel Paul, who's the founder and CEO of Easy Orthopedics. You can learn more about Dr. Paul at easyorthopedics.com or on his YouTube channel, Beyond the Scalpel. MedEdge is brought to you by Medtrix. Medtrix, practice medicine, not software. You can learn more at medtrixlab.com. For Santosh Charian and everyone on the MedEdge team, I'm Marcus Grimm.